The following is a presentation of the Matt Talk Podcast Network.
Welcome to On the Mat. I am Kyle Klingman, along with a man who has a title with a J, Andy Hamilton of TrackWrestling.com. Welcome, Andrew, to another excellent edition. We're going to have a Duke flavor to this. Jacob Casper will have his Casper's Corner momentarily, and then we're going to have the head wrestling coach, Glenn Lanham of Duke, on the show. So I hope you're up for it.
I am up for it. I'm excited about it.
Should be. This was your suggestion that you had suggested right after Nationals. And I just would like to know what triggered the thought, because you said we have to get Glenn Lanham on the program.
A couple years ago, Travis Johnson, who writes our D1 Insider for us, he was writing at the time we were doing notebooks on every conference. And Travis had a situation he had to attend to, and I had to pinch hit for him. And so I just reached out to a couple people, Steve Garland for one and Glenn Lanham for another, just for some story ideas to write that notebook for Travis that week. And had a conversation with Glenn and just got a little bit of a idea of what they deal with down there. And talking a budget, I think at the time was right in the range of $150,000, and no athletic scholarships for the wrestling program at Duke, and just a lot of things that they were up against, and still having to have some success. And so then you see Duke graduates Jacob Casper, and then the Feinsilvers step in, and you got Mitch Feinsilver. Finishing, I think, fourth at 149 pounds this year. Duke manages to still finish in the top 25, 24th place finish. And you look at some of the programs around them in the standings, and there are some programs with some pretty rich tradition. There are some programs that are in some pretty fertile recruiting bases. There are a lot of programs in there, 9.9 scholarships, and yet there's Duke right alongside them. And I think it's a tremendous story. And really excited to see where that program goes. But I think just so many layers to Glenn's story that are really compelling, and really excited to have him on the show.
And to get back-to-back Duke. Who would have thought that on this podcast, which started in 2007, we would have two representatives of Duke? I don't think I ever saw that coming. Because at one point, I would have never even known that Duke had a program. And I don't know that it ever became on my radar until Conrad Dudziak, 10 years or so ago?
Yeah.
That was the first time I probably had any awareness that Duke had a wrestling program.
And how about the fact that one of those Duke guests is Jacob Casper? And for people who have been listening to our program for past couple years, even before we went to the podcast format, they might remember that Jacob Casper was the last guest on the radio show.
Yeah, that's right.
The one time that I pinch hit for you there, Kyle, and we bring that show to its knees, basically. Yeah. It's the one and only time. Now, that's, you like to tell people that that's not the reason, or at least that's the reason, or not the reason you tell me, but it was one and done for me as a show host on the radio there.
Well, hey, we went through it. I was in jury duty, and we talked it through and thought this would be a better format, and it ended up being that way. But if I remember, didn't you record it and then have to re-record it? Is that right?
Yeah, so the audio quality wasn't real good. I think what it was maybe it sounded okay on the radio, and then once Jason Bryant got his hands on it, he's like, yes, this isn't very good. And so we went back, we re-recorded it. Jacob was kind enough to come back on, rejoin us the following day. And I told him, I said, man, that was awesome stuff, and I don't want to lose it. Our audience needs to hear it. And so he came back on, joined us for another 15-minute segment or so, and knocked it out of the park for the second straight day. And And then we went to this format, which I'm glad we have. I think this has worked out really well. We're not confined to maybe like a 18-minute segment like we were in the past. We can kind of see how long that we want to take a guest and how much time they have. And, man, we've got some really cool stuff out of this.
And think about that. You're right about that, to be confined to 18 minutes for one guest and then 15 for the other. The format was two guests, one 18 minutes, one 15, hard cutoff. And to think about that in hindsight, you're really doing a disservice because you had to get on it. You had to get questions where you might have two or three questions and you're out. And now these athletes, coaches, hopefully some parents at some point, have an opportunity to just articulate their story with no rush, and we can dive as deep as we need to. And we're looking forward to diving deep with Glenn Lanham. Before we get to topics, what do you say we just maybe transition into our Casper's Corner? We missed him and we want to get into this. So let's go to another edition of Casper's Corner. It is time for another edition of Casper's Corner with two-time All-American Jacob Casper from Duke. And we've missed you, man. We tried to do something maybe at Nationals and just never materialized. And here we get to have you back on. And it doesn't really mean we're not any less nervous. We're still nervous about what you're going to ask, but it's also thrilling at the same time, Jacob.
I'm excited to be back on. Thanks for having me. Yeah, I think Mitch Feinsilver threw a little wrench into plans. We were hoping, you know, maybe he wouldn't be on that backside at any point or get an opportunity to do it at Nationals, but that didn't come to fruition. But I'm excited to bring back the people what they want. They want the question. They want to sit on the edge of their seats and have the sweaty palms and try to, you know, muster up an answer if there is a correct one to the question. So this segment's question is two part. First, as a high school competitor, which tournament would you most want to win? Fargo, a state title, Super 32, Flow Nationals, Folk Style Nationals, or any other tournament?
So you're asking of those tournaments, which one would you want to win?
Any tournament out there. Those are just some of the big ones that most kids would list.
Okay.
If you could win it, you know, age group level title at the high school level as a high school competitor, which would you want to win?
Did you put state in there, your own state tournament?
Yeah, own state tournament. That was, so I'll repeat. I had written down Fargo, state title, Super 32, Flow Nationals, Folk Style Nationals.
We have to pick from those, or can we go outside of those?
You can go outside of those if you're thinking like Cadet Worlds and things like that.
I was going to say the Olympics.
Yeah, if you could win it as a high schooler, I mean, absolutely, right?
Yeah.
Well, yeah. For me, it's really a no-brainer, and it's your high school state wrestling championship. That still holds so much weight, and that's what you get to have for the rest of your life. That's what your friends know about. That's what they understand. And it's just like anything. It's just, if you win a world championship, that's a maybe a bigger deal than actually making an Olympic team or maybe even winning the Olympics. But to the general population, to say you're an Olympian or to say you're a world champion, in the general public's eyes, saying you're an Olympian is a bigger deal than saying you're a world champion. So the same thing holds true with being a state champion. You want street cred among all of your high school students, all of your friends. State championship is still the number one. I'm going with that.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's what it's hard for me because I never won any of them. So as an outsider's perspective, I agree though. I think a state title is what I would have wanted as a young kid. That's what you're aspiring to. Even though, you know, you watch Fargo, you watch Flow Nationals, Folk Style Nationals, Super 32, Ironman, all those tough tournaments, that the pinnacle always seems to be the state tournament. The guys that are the four timers are the ones that get the standing ovations and awesome stuff like that. So I would completely agree. I would go as a high school competitor, state title.
And the other thing too is that whenever you list a record of a high school wrestler, so we just had Brent Metcalf on the show last week. We said he was undefeated in high school. Well, he lost some matches in high school, but we're talking about his actual high school scholastic career. And that's right. What gets listed in the program. That's what people focus on. So I've always felt like winning a state championship is number one. And you could also transfer it to U.S. Open that's coming up, or winning the NCAA championship. Hey, winning the NCAA championship, you have 4 years to do it. That's really the ultimate national championship is the collegiate one. And whether you want to say which is more difficult or not, the one that holds the most street cred to me is nationals that happens collegiately and then your own high school state tournament.
No, I agree. And then the follow-up question to that would be then, as a college coach, which would you put the most weight into when you're recruiting kids? Because while a state tournament might be, you know, good, there are weaker states, there are weaker divisions, and all types of things. So if, as a high school coach or as a college coach, which are you looking for in a high school athlete the most? Are you looking at Super 32, Flow Nationals, Folk Style Nationals, Ironman? You still looking at state titles? Are you looking at Fargo now?
Well, I think, yeah, to your point, not all state titles are created equal, right? I mean, you win a state title in California, the largest participation numbers in one class. It's different than some other states where they hand out seven state titles per weight class, you know, six, seven state titles per weight class, that many divisions. So I would say probably Super 32 if I'm a coach, because number one, it's a folk style event. You know, we're recruiting folk style wrestlers. We want to see what they can do in folk style positions. So I think that's really important. And then number two, it's all these guys that are competing in it are ramping up for their high school seasons. At that point, you get into some of the postseason tournaments, you'll see some weird results at that point where some people maybe have taken a few weeks off. Some others are just coming off state championship events. So that kind of changes the game a little bit from a conditioning standpoint, too. So I would say Super 32.
And this is the perfect follow-up question because it lends to what you talked about. It's what's most recognizable and what actually matters. And they're completely different topics, which is great that you're following up with that, because I've always felt like Fargo was the one that when you're a Fargo All-American, that's where people focus and that's where coaches look to. That if you get to be a Fargo All-American, you automatically become on a coach's radar. And that would be my choice, even though it's freestyle. I feel like you get a placing at Fargo, that holds credibility and coaches are going to automatically seek you out. So your follow-up question, what would your answer be?
I don't know. This is something that I've gone back and forth with. While like Super 32 and Fargo are both super tough, you see at the upper weights a lot of the times guys have been committed to the football season.
Sure.
And some of the upper weights are, you know, watered down. And while your champ or top three or top five are still tough, there are guys that sneak onto an All-American finish or sneak onto the podium and maybe a weaker weight. So it's kind of hard to justify those. You know, Ironman's an invite where only certain guys get to compete, so you're getting the same type of deal. It's kind of hard to justify any of them. You know, there's also the argument that Fargo's freestyle and Greco rather than Super 32, which is folk style. But I think at the end of the day, I probably would go with maybe Fargo freestyle as well, just to show that kids are willing to compete in the summer. You know, kind of the same reasons you just said that some of those summer results are wonky. I want to see that a kid's competing through the summer, working hard through the summer, is willing to expose himself to different types of styles of wrestling, is willing to, you know, go out to Fargo, North Dakota to compete on a big stage and wrestle for his national team to represent his state. So I think that's probably why I would put the most weight in a Fargo or Super 32 type event, especially over a state title, which as the competitor I would take.
This is a great question because it lends to a lot of deeper questions too, which is always what your questions are about. But I've heard that even as it compares to the Kentucky Derby, which is the only horse race I know, or the Triple Crown. But I've heard that there are horse races out there that are much tougher and have better horses, but that's the one we know about. And I think it's the same thing with wrestling. We know about a select few tournaments as a general population. It's the Collegiate Nationals, it's the Olympic Games, and probably your state. I'd say those are the big three. But if you're in the know, you know that in wrestling, there are tournaments that are higher level than that, and that winning the world team trials is really more impressive than winning the NCAA championships because you have more competition and you have better competition. But to the general population, it's going to be a different game, and how they view it is quite a bit different.
Yeah, absolutely. Something interesting to me when I, you know, lived my time with Daniel Cormier out in California was we were watching the fights, and I believe it was Yoel Romero came up, and they listed his Olympic accomplishments only, which his Olympic accomplishments are actually less than what he accomplished at the world level. So they, you know, they, he's an Olympic silver medalist, but they don't list his world title or whatever it may be. I don't entirely remember now. I remember asking DC, like, why would the UFC do that and not promote this guy as a world champion like he is or whatever the situation was? And he said the general public, the UFC has done like studies on, you know, small select groups, and the general public puts more weight into an Olympic, you know, medal rather than a world title in a non-Olympic year. So the UFC uses the Olympic events, to promote, you know, their fighters rather than a world championship result, which I always thought was really, really weird, even if it favored, the world championship year over the Olympic year.
Yeah. And I think too, with you talking about the UFC, that's a perfect example is that 2008, Henry Cejudo is an Olympic champion, which is unbelievable. He got to that point, and very few do, but nobody's talking about that he placed second at the U.S. Open that year and got pinned in the finals of that tournament. It's just irrelevant after that point. But once you do a deeper dive, you just realize that there isn't just a magic wand that says once you have an Olympic title that it opens doors and it's going to be easy to win UFC matches. And I think that's a great comparison, a great point with what you're asking with these questions.
Absolutely. I hope I didn't disappoint with the question this time.
Well, you more than you doubled your excitement because you gave us two questions. So they gave us double the reasons to think. Hey, before we let you go, we got Glenn Lanham on the program. You got a question you want us to ask him?
That's a good question. I guess I'd like to know who Coach Lanham enjoyed sitting in the chair the most for out of the three All-Americans he's coached at his time here, between Connor Hartman, Mitch Feinsilver, and myself. Who did he enjoy the most sitting in the chair with?
We will definitely ask that. We'll push him in your direction if he doesn't answer Jacob Casper.
Tip him.
Well, yeah, we'll steer him. We'll just say, hey, we've got an inside track here. We think it should be Jake Casper, but we'll let
him. There we go. We share an office, so if he's got the wrong answer, I'm going to be upset. I'm going to have to take it up with him.
All right. Hey, we've enjoyed this. We'll get you back on for another Casper's Corner. We enjoyed it. Thanks for giving us another exhilarating edition of Casper's Corner.
Thanks so much for having me on. Send in those questions if anybody thinks of any out there.
All right. We appreciate it. Thank you to Jacob Casper for enlightening us again. I think always when we get these questions, we have no idea where he's going to come from. And that was actually a topic that is near and dear to me because he really went into some ideas and some concepts about how the public receives wrestling or any sport for that matter, how wrestling people, the people in the know view it, but I like being in the know, and so I think there's tournaments and there's world team trials that if people only understood the world team trials at any level, whether it's U23s, senior world team trials, juniors, you're going to see some of your absolute best wrestling there. And if you're a fan of this sport, you're missing out if you don't go.
Yeah, 100%. It's such an entertaining style, entertaining brand of wrestling now, and the level of talent in the United States is off the charts. We're seeing so many, you know, we've talked at length about this numerous times on the show, just the amount of talent coming up through the pipeline at this point. And so we're seeing guys straight out of high school that are able to compete at a high level. Guys still in high school able to compete at a high level. Andrew Aliris going out to the Schultz, placing fourth out there, beating Dean Heil and Joey Lazor out there, having a couple barn burner matches with Bryce Meredith. I mean, that's just one illustration. But, you know, we saw it a year ago, Gable Steveson, was he fourth at fourth on the ladder at the Challenge Tournament up in Rochester. So, yeah, we're seeing guys that are more equipped than ever to win at an early age, and what it's doing is producing a lot of depth in the system now. And now I think even, you know, a guy that we go back 10 years ago, Logan Stieber was having success right away, going into the senior level and making waves out in Vegas as an 18-year-old. Really cool what he did right away. Guy that just announced his retirement We definitely need to talk about his career.
Yeah, what did you think about that? Did you see it coming?
Just the timing was a little bit unusual in that here we are a couple weeks out from the Open, and he would have had to have gone through that. But, you know, I know that also a guy that's dealt with some injuries here in the past couple of years, back, neck stuff. And, you know, also when a guy that has accomplished what he has, what more is there for him to do? Well, yeah, he could go win another world title, I suppose, or make an Olympic team, win an Olympic medal. But, in conversations with Logan, he certainly wanted it to end with an Olympic gold medal. But so few athletes in our sport get to end it that way. And a lot of times your body dictates when you get out more than your results do. And so he's at peace with everything and knows that one question I asked him is, I said, you know, a lot of athletes, you know, they know when it's time to go. They know when it's time to hang it up. Was this apparent to you? And he said, yeah, absolutely. It was here in the last few weeks and months. And so he said he'd given it some thought after last year, after the World Championships in Budapest, and body just didn't quite respond this year. And so going out is one of the all-time greats in United States history.
And you have to go back. He just has a story that I think is worth examining. Here's a guy who was in Faces in the Crowd with his brother Hunter in Sports Illustrated and came on the scene at a young age and was successful at the lightest weight class and did well at the World Team Trials. Wins 4 NCAA championships, one of 4 people to accomplish that. Won a world championship in 2016 in that non-Olympic year in a non-Olympic weight class. And by the way, I think that is absolutely a world championship, and anyone who tries to diminish that, don't listen to them, because it is fully a world championship. Because, hey, those guys that were in the fully contested 10 weight classes, and then you shrink down to 6, that is a huge accomplishment. So world champion in Logan Stieber has just a great resume, and I think it's Hall of Fame worthy. I think he's a first ballot Hall of Famer, and you're probably not going to see a career quite like his again, Andy.
You know what's really weird, Kyle? Is Logan Stieber never won the Open. I couldn't believe that when I was looking at his bio. Yeah. Yeah. 3rd in 2009, 6th in 2010, 4th in 2013, 3rd in 2014, 4th in 2015, 2nd in 2016, 3rd in 2018. And so he obviously was able to sit out there after winning the world championship in 2016. But that was really fascinating to me.
I think that makes Casper's Corner even more relevant, because what we're talking about is you see the 4 NCAA championships, but never got a U.S. Open title. I would have never guessed that until you just read it to me.
I know. It's almost like, is there something I'm missing here when looking at his bio? But, everywhere that I've highlighted it, and it has 7 appearances at the U.S. Open, and the best he did was a 2nd in 2016. But that's not to diminish his career, because obviously one of the all-time greats, 4 NCAA titles puts him in a class of 4 right now. Combine that with a world title. One of the things that's really cool to me about Logan Stieber, he won a high school state team title and 4 Ohio State individual titles. He won an NCAA title as a team at Ohio State, 4 NCAA titles there. And then he won a team title with Team USA 2017. That's a rare group of athletes who have won team titles and individual titles at those 3 levels.
I think he'd be the only one.
Him and Kyle Snyder, I think.
But he didn't win 4.
No, but Kyle won 3, of course, but parts of high school state, Division I team, and USA wrestling men's freestyle titles. I don't know if there's anybody from the 90s that were part of high school state titles as well as Division I team titles, and then went on and wrestled on those world championship teams. But those 2 come to mind right away, Snyder and Stieber.
We'll miss seeing him wrestle. Certainly a guy that was a big part of college wrestling and beyond. And I don't think you can fully capture what that is about when you have a class of four. You have Pat Smith, you have Cale Sanderson, you have Kyle Dake, and you have Logan Stieber. It's those names alone, you just put that out there and you have a class of four. Only they can understand what it takes to do that four times in a row. They can have their private conversations, just like being president of the United States. You don't know what it's like until you do it. Those guys are in an elite and rare class.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So, Kyle, we've kind of buried the lead here a little bit, or one of the leads, and got some stuff to talk about here.
Tons of stuff.
You talked at the Open about the J, and I wondered where we were going with that. Can you explain that?
Yeah, well, you're wearing a jacket from Bucharest, and it has the letter J on there. And I guess it's actually, I thought it might have been Nike. I don't know why. I saw the J there. I thought it meant been a label for you, or they're calling you J. I don't know, but it's a brand called Jago, right?
Joma. It's a European brand, I guess.
So, and then I saw that as we're doing the show, and I remember an article you wrote called Title with a J about Jay Robinson, who does not spell his name J-A-Y. It's J with no period.
This is J with no period. So people maybe thought I stole this from Jay Robinson, maybe.
And that's kind of what I thought. And so,
give it to him as a gift.
Yeah. I didn't think you stole it from him, but I saw that and I thought of Jay Robinson. So that was the story behind the nickname. And I liked the story. If I remember right reading it, I think there was a picture of Jay at the piano and you went into some of his different stories that he likes to tell. And you put it best with Jay, is that when Jay gives you an interview, he writes the story for you. And I think he's one of the few people you can say that about. You don't have to do much with the Jay Robinson interview.
No.
You just string together some quotes and then he just says things for you. And it's not too difficult to write a Jay Robinson piece.
The thing I love about Jay, too, is sometimes I feel like he just likes to pick an opposing side just for the heck of it, just to debate with you.
Sure he does.
I get a kick out of that. Or it doesn't even matter. Like, you can totally agree with what he really believes in, but he will challenge you on it. That's kind of fun.
All the time. He loves to challenge, no matter what it is. He just loves that. And 42 years upcoming, I think, for Jay Robinson camps. So that's a great run for him. And again, he will quit when it's over for him. He will go all the way to the finish line. And I think that's just so commendable of Jay, that he has that staying power and he's resilient as they get.
Yeah. And hoping that we get the opportunity here in the next few weeks to visit with him. I think we will. I think that's on our agenda.
Yeah.
And there's a lot on our agenda.
There,
Kyle.
Is. Yeah. Some transitions taking place for me in particular, just moving over to a new role with Track Wrestling right now. That's been out there a little bit because the National Wrestling Hall of Fame, Dan Gable Museum, or the National Wrestling Hall of Fame put out a press release about that. But our first time talking about it officially, and just really honored to be a part of this. You were a huge part in getting me to this point and getting me on the Track Wrestling team. So very excited about that and what the opportunities hold. And this podcast will only continue to get better as we continue to find ways to improve this, but really excited to be on the team.
Excited to have you on the team.
Be good. And with that, I just think it's fun to learn about the story about, especially Justin Tritz. This guy's a stud. This guy's an absolute stud in starting this from scratch. And I think anytime you start from scratch and you get to this point where it's bigger than I could have ever imagined, hey, having an event management system that's absolutely revolutionized how the sport is perceived, how we track results. I think that you have to really give a tip of the cap to him on what he's done to get it to this point. Just grateful for what he's done and his pioneering efforts that I get to be part of this.
It's crazy. You know, and we've talked about this before off air, and I sometimes forget what we've told on air and what we've told off, but it really struck me, the power of Track Wrestling, several years ago at the Iowa State High School tournament, where it used to be that everything was done on paper, and we get our results. We get bracket updates. They'd have runners bringing around updates with results and brackets onto Press Row, and that's what we depended on. And then everything went digital. And 1 year at the state tournament, and they were never real creative with their password for the Wi-Fi. It was always something like wrestling and then the year, or even just wrestling. And so 15,000 people would log into the Wi-Fi. They'd get it after about 15 minutes into the tournament, and the Wi-Fi would grind to a halt. And 1 year I'm sitting there thinking, we're watching the tournament Matt side, and literally anywhere else on earth, if you've got internet connection, you can log into Track Wrestling and have a better idea of what's going on than all of us sitting Matt side on Press Row with the way the Wi-Fi was working there. And so it's really cool that in live time, you can be pretty much anywhere on earth with an internet connection and be able to follow a tournament in real time. I think that's awesome. And the amount of tournaments that operate now on Track Wrestling, and the amount of tournaments that stream on Track Wrestling, it's staggering.
And to be part of that, it's going to be so fun to keep driving this forward and just providing content with you. It's going to be a blast.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun, and certainly we're all ears if people have story ideas, if they have ideas of guests that they want on this program, or people they think we need to talk to, or stories we need to tell. Certainly reach out to Kyle and myself, and we'll do our best to tell those stories.
We love mailbag items, and before we get to Glenn Lanham, topic for today is one that we touched on last week, but we didn't get a chance to really examine this close, and that is, what does it mean to have a rivalry? And I think for you, it's probably the commonplace that you have to win matches in a rivalry or keep it competitive. I don't know what the numerical value is, but I've never thought that. I don't think you have to win a match necessarily to have it be considered a rivalry. So even in college, I think that Dake and Taylor was absolutely a rivalry, even though Taylor didn't win a match in it. I do. I think that Full Heart, Hartung, even though I think it was, 7-1 in favor of Hartung, maybe even higher than that, 8-1, 9-1, whatever it was, Full Heart won one match. I think that was one of our great rivalries. I think it's more of a concept of how competitive it is, and do you go in thinking either guy has the potential to win? If you can answer that question and say yes, I think that's what constitutes a rivalry.
I think that's fair. It does have to be competitive. You have to have both sides going in thinking they had a chance.
Especially with Oklahoma State and Iowa being an example in wrestling. And I've heard John Smith say this is, hey, we need to pick up a win if we're going to call this a rivalry because maybe Iowa won a spell. I don't know about that. I understand that from John's perspective, that you're competitive and you want to be that team that just isn't losing all the time and losing 5 or 6 in a row. But especially in the Iowa State case, I mean, you've covered this as much as anyone. At what point do you say it's no longer a rivalry, though? I mean, that's a great topic because they haven't won since 05.
Yeah, I think it's like 45 out of 47 or something like that, 46 out of 48, 44 out of 46, somewhere in there, because Iowa reeled off 30 in a row, and then Iowa State won 2, and then Iowa has won, I think, now 15, 16 in a row, whatever it is, since then. And this year was a big step for Iowa State in making it a rivalry again. It's a great dual meet. It was competitive, and Cyclones had some things go their way to make it a super close duel, a down to the wire duel. But I think we're to the point now where, they're going to make it competitive where they're not losing 8, 9 out of 10 matches. And so, you got some interesting storylines on both sides now, the Kevin Dresser, Tom Brands history there with Virginia Tech, and Brent Metcalf, Derek St. John winning national titles for Tom Brands at Iowa. So there's some interesting angles there. Iowa State doing well recruiting in state. That adds some intrigue to it, I think. And
It's going to be fun. It's going to be fun for years to come.
So as we talk about rivals, we're saying that it has to be competitive. Now that it's over and a college wrestling rivalry, can we say Colin Moore, Bo Nickel was a rivalry? Maybe going in, you thought it was going to be, but I think it's probably...
I don't think we ever got to that point.
Yeah.
I don't think we ever got to that point. I mean, we had a first period pin. We had a, you know what?
Major?
I think it was right on the cusp of a major and then 5-1.
Yeah.
In the finals.
Yeah, probably not in that scenario.
I don't think we ever really got to that point. You know, when you're talking Bo Nickel's college rival, I would say it's Miles Martin, only guy that beat him multiple times.
Yeah. And as we've talked about rivalries and what makes it great, hey, Kenny Monday, Nate Carr definitely was because they just kept going back and forth. It was like ping pong going back and forth who was going to win and who wasn't. And so I think that takes it to another level. A great rivalry is they're going to go back and forth and one guy's going to win a couple matches and maybe the other guy does too. So I don't know how many we've had of those though. It's hard because a lot of times they might not be in conferences and you have to find ways for them to meet, but I think we're continuing to find ways with social media and calling people out that we're seeing more and more of that all the time.
Who would be your rival, Kyle? What's your greatest rival?
Personally?
Yeah.
Oh, man. I like this question. Probably Jason Bryant.
Yeah?
Yeah. Yeah. He'd be my rival. I don't think he'd be my question. Not for anything negative, but I'd say he'd be my number one rival.
Okay.
Especially in the way we execute life and the way we see the world, he'd be my rival.
Okay.
Do you have one?
Probably my Airdyne. Okay. And I got to make it more competitive. I've got to make it more competitive than what it's been because that thing's been getting the best of me here for a while.
How about a human being, though? Do you have a human being that would be your rival or maybe even a dog? I mean, something that actually moves. Do you have a dog that caused you some grief? I mean, you're a dog guy, too.
I don't know.
You don't have
I don't know. I get some pretty good debates with Sparks. I love those.
That'd be your rival then.
We're friends, though. Well, we're good friends.
You can be friends and rivals, can't you?
Hey, he let me have it over one of the Casper's corners here in the past. And then I won him over. I turned him around.
I got to say, I've changed my position on that too. I know that's a revelation to you on this show that you didn't know I was going to say that, but I am coming around to your way of thinking and Jacob Casper's because of the way you've articulated your defense on that. And so we're going back to the question of whether you would win an NCAA championship knowing you didn't reach your full potential or play second knowing you fully reached your potential. And what turned the corner for me is when you said, once you have that mentality, you have it for life because that's who you are. So if you reach second and you reached every single bit of your ability, that's a lifelong principle that you have. Or if you cut corners and you won it,
you get blinded by success.
You get blinded by it. So I like that. And you know what? I think in your conversation with Gable, I think he would agree with that at some level. I don't know all the way. And it's still such a great question from Casper's corner that it's still conflicting because once you're there and you reach the finals, you want to get that championship and you want to get it done. But you've articulated it in such a good way that I think it deserves deeper consideration. What do you say we get to our guest today, Glenn Lanham? You excited about this?
Yeah. Let's go out to Durham, North Carolina, Kyle.
All right, let's do it. Our guest today is the head wrestling coach at Duke. We're going to find more about that position. Also a two-time All-American, get this, Andy, for two schools, Tennessee and Oklahoma State. Glenn Lanham is our guest. How are you, Glenn?
Doing well. How about yourself, guys?
We're doing great. And just right away, Tennessee and then Oklahoma State, I have to imagine the reason you were at Tennessee was because you wanted to go there. And then the reason you went to Oklahoma State is because they dropped the program at Tennessee. Is that pretty close to accurate?
Oh, no doubt. Yeah, that's exactly. I didn't have a choice in the second one. My dad was like, you are not going to a program that doesn't have any tradition. So we're going to. You're not going to do this twice, so you're going to go to Oklahoma State. So I ended up going.
Why Tennessee initially?
You know, it was funny. My high school coach wrestled at Lock Haven for Gray Simons. So that was one of my last visits to go down to the University of Tennessee. So I went there, and there was a lot of connections. There was a guy that was a couple of years older than me, Chris Edmonds, ended up being a national champion. Tim Cochran, a kid from Pennsylvania. Wayne Caton, a two-time national runner-up. So it was just a good mix of guys there, all young. But I thought that a group that could definitely turn that program around. So my workout partner, Tony Mills, was there, and just another great guy to work out and train with. So I just thought it was a program on the rise, and I just wanted to be a part of building something like that. So that's why I ended up going there.
Tell me about Chris Edmond. You were an All-American at 158. You placed eighth that year, and then Chris Edmond won it at 167. If I remember right, his opponent, Pete Capone from Hofstra, I think they were both from New York. I think they missed wrestling each other in the high school state tournament. I think he got third and Capone got first, maybe. And then they wrestled in the finals of the NCAA championships. What do you remember about that?
I remember because I knew that. Because we used to go up to Hofstra and train for our freestyle club, and Chris and Capone would be up there. And, you know, Capone could kind of hold his own, but Chris would always catch Capone in a throw, you know? And when Chris got past, I forgot the kid from Oklahoma, when he got past him and it was Capone in the finals, I knew he was going to be a national champ. Because I never saw him lose to Capone. So it was just obviously to have two New York guys and just two guys that you know, but obviously a teammate in the finals was just great to watch. And, you know, Chris has been a great workout partner and a great friend. We still keep in touch, go out to Nationals, and he's out there, and we have a little bike team. But, yeah, just a super guy.
And the year before, he got fourth place, and he got turned like everyone did by Mike Sheets. Did you experience that that toughness on top from Mike Sheets?
I did. I did experience that. Mike Sheets used to come and work out with us quite a bit, and it was my roommate Chris Bond. He was a two-time national champ, and one day in the spring we were working out, and Sheets came in there, and you know Mike was very tough on top, but on your feet, you could kind of get Mike every now and then. So, you know, Chris and I, we had a good day against Mike, and Mike was in the bathroom and Chris didn't see him. And, Chris was just talking about how, you know, how we got Mike. And I was just like trying to tell him, hey, Mike's in the toilet. Don't say that. Don't say that. But Chris kept on talking. So Mike came out. He didn't say a word. The next day in practice, he grabbed, me and Chris again. He's like, hey, you guys want to go again? And I was like, I knew what was going to happen. he got on Chris and turned him every which way but loose. But it was a very painful session for Chris.
Now, of course, big weight difference. You were 158. John Smith was 134. But you guys were teammates there in 1987. First of all, did you guys ever work out? Any chance you guys drilled or went live at any capacity?
We drilled. We never went live. But we drilled quite a bit. John, you know, just watching him and just learning technique from him and how diligent he was to just hone his craft, it was unbelievable. I've never seen anybody work as hard as John did about just perfecting technique, trying to develop. Because John wasn't the strongest guy. He was super flexible in his hips. But he wasn't strong. I would see guys that were in his weight class that he would wrestle, and I would think, like, you know, they're just physically, they look just, they're going to overpower him. And just John could get the angles and just move people. And if I learned anything from John, it was just how to get to angles and move people and always be looking for angles. And I still work that today, is just how to get the angles and how to get the shots, because John was a master at doing that kind of stuff. He wasn't the strongest, like I said, but his technique was, you know, better than anybody's born in.
How was that being a teammate overall? Was he in his own lane and he was off to the side? Did you guys build a relationship? How was that? How did that develop at Oklahoma State?
No, it was great. John you know, when I got there, John was one of the first ones to welcome me to the team. And matter of fact, my John doesn't show his a bar series on top, but so I got to Oklahoma State, and you know, I was taking a lot of people down, but really wasn't doing a lot on top. And I remember John in the locker room coming to me and said, "Hey, when it counts, you're gonna have to be able to ride guys. You know, you're not gonna be able to take down guys a lot." So he said, "Hey, let's go over this series and try to really, you know, you're not a leg guy, but maybe you can do a bar series." So John showed me an arm bar series, and then I added a little bit, and we still do it to this day. But, you know, a lot of Oklahoma State guys do it, and I think a lot of it came from John, because, you know, just breaking guys down and using a bar, and that's something that, you know, you don't hear about people talking about John. They always talk about his little single. If you look at a lot of stuff, John could ride guys in tournament. And he showed me a bar series to keep guys down, a bar to a claw. And I, like I said, I show our guys, and I use it to this day.
We're always fascinated by people who reach a level that is nearly untouchable. Jordan Burroughs is closing in on some of those records that John had, but to win 6 world and Olympic championships in a row. Can you just describe John Smith and how he was able to get that done?
You know, guys say they hate to lose, but they don't put in the time. And I saw John, my senior year, he got there at Oklahoma State. He got beat, one time. And, you know, just to see him come back from that and take a positive and turn that negative into a positive. But the amount of time he put in, to just not letting that happen again, it was unbelievable. You know, you sit around and I would try to match his workouts and just the time he spent, and it was exhausting. You just could not do it. And I think that's what separates, you know, good wrestlers from great wrestlers, you know, national champions from all Americans, and Olympians from Olympic champions. It's just everybody's competitive, but John, he was like, if you can compare it to basketball, he was a Michael Jordan competitive. He hated to lose in anything. It didn't matter.
You lost in the semifinals of the 1987 championships to Ken Hasselrig of Clarion, 1-1-1-1, Criteria 11. What the heck is Criteria 11?
You know, I couldn't figure it out. They had going into the overtime match, they had a criteria that you had to, if you had a stalling, then that took precedent over anything except a takedown, obviously. So, Hasselrig got dinged for stalling. And, coach was just like, Coach C was just like, "Hey, just take some riding time off the clock. Let the clock go down to 0-0, and you had the match." And I knew that Hasselrig couldn't take me down, and he was definitely hard to take down. So I looked at the clock. I was on top of him. I looked at the clock. It showed 0-0. I let him up, trying to get a takedown or maybe a stall call. And the referee, the clock went out. They raised my hand. I went back in the locker room to cut weight. They called us back to the mat. And they raised his hand and said that there was time on the clock, and it was crazy because they went back, they reviewed it. There was no time on the clock. We sat on the mat. They shut wrestling down for like 45 minutes. There was no wrestling in the arena. We just sat there for 45 minutes, and you know, it was funny. A little voice in my mind just said, "Hey, prepared me for this," because it was like, you know, "Hey, you're not going to win this, so just be ready. Don't go crazy." So, sure enough, after 45 minutes, they announced him the winner, and I walked off the mat and got ready for the next day. I was just a shell of myself. My only regret of that whole tournament, obviously, is losing, but not finishing the tournament. I tell our guys all the time, for me, it was do or die. I wanted to be a national champion. I envisioned myself doing that. And when that didn't take place, yeah, it was devastating for me, but, you know, it is what it is, but it was just the craziest match in the world, and how they scored it and how the referee figured it out. It was beyond me.
What did you think when your head coach, Joe C at Oklahoma State, approached you for the Iowa dual meet and said, "We want you to bump up a weight class and wrestle Royce Alger"?
I loved it. I did that twice, actually. I bumped up against Alinsky and at the Virginia duels, and then I bumped up obviously at the Iowa duel. I was like, when he said it, he didn't have to say it twice. I was like, yeah, let's do it. I would love the opportunity to wrestle Alger. I hear a lot of things about him, and I wanted to go up there and tangle with him, and obviously came out on the wrong end of it, but I had no problem with it.
What's it like being in a dynasty? Oklahoma State is a wrestling dynasty. When you're there, you go from Tennessee to Oklahoma State. What was that like? We asked the same question to Kevin Jackson, because he went to LSU to Iowa State, kind of the same thing. Right. What's it like going Tennessee to Oklahoma State?
I think that, the whole mentality is different. So when I went on my recruiting trip, Myron Roderick was the AD there, and he was showing me around. And, Tennessee, the wrestling room in Tennessee, it was better than the wrestling room at Oklahoma State. So I'm walking, Coach Roderick is in front of me, and I say under my breath, but I obviously heard it. I said, "Wow, is this it?" And Coach Roderick turns around and he says, "What did you say?" And I said, I said, "Is this it?" And he's like, he starts naming off the Olympians and national champions and all Americans. And he's like, "If it's good enough for you, if it's good enough for them, it's good enough for you." And I remember just when he said that, you go on these visits and you're an all American and everybody is like, they roll out the red carpet and they're saying things that you want to hear. And Coach Roderick was like, "This is our culture. Either you fit or go someplace else." And I remember that. I was like, right then and there, I was like, I'm coming here. I'm coming here, because it was like the tradition of Oklahoma State. That program means so much to me, and it still does. And if Duke's not winning, I want Oklahoma State. I'm still a diehard Cowboy. And just I learned tradition there. I learned how to, just to compete. I learned to get over obstacles. And I learned no matter, what situation you're in, you win. And that's what I got from being at Oklahoma State. I remember I had a pair of red wrestling shoes that I won my last match and was an All-American in. And first day of practice, I come in there with those, and I'm working out with those. Coach Roderick, he comes into practice, and he's like, "Hey, take those shoes off." And I was like, "Excuse me, Coach?" He said, "Take those off. We don't wear red in here." And I was like, "All right." He said, "And matter of fact, don't ever wear anything red in here again." So I was like, okay. But you just learn pride, and you learn what I learned there at Oklahoma State is just take pride in your program, take pride in your singlet, take pride in, the university you represent, and just the culture when you step on the mat as a Cowboy. There's a lot of pride that goes into that. And that's what I learned there. And that's what I try to do at Duke. It's the same thing. I try to do the same thing.
We're talking about a time before cell phones and social media. And when, Kyle brings up our conversation with Kevin Jackson, and he heard that LSU had gotten dropped when he was up here in Cedar Falls, Iowa at doing a camp at Northern Iowa, and heard from the coaches at Northern Iowa that LSU had been dropped. How did you hear about Tennessee having the program being cut?
We came back from NCAAs, and it was the team's best finish in history. They told us that they're going to discontinue the program. They said that, because I remember going, I heard rumors, and I was like, I went down and I tried to find Coach Simons, and he was in his office, and he was bawling, and he was like, "Hey, you know, whatever you need to for me to do to take care of you, to get your name out there, or whatever you need to do, just let me know, because they're gonna drop the program." And I remember, you know, just seeing Coach Simons in that state. I was furious. I went up to our AD's office. Doug Dickey was the AD. And I just went in and I just lit into him. I mean, I was mad. I knocked, papers off his desk. And, you know, I was just like, cause I was totally confused. I was like, you know, this program made a turnaround. You know, guys are not getting in trouble. We're graduating our athletes. Everybody's doing the right things. And I just couldn't understand it. And, you know, it was like, he was like, well, it's a Title IX. It's an equity thing. And, I just didn't get it, because if you talk about a program that just like skimped by, we took Vans everywhere. We, you know, under budget and overperformed. That's what we did at Tennessee. And I just, you know, people, talk about, Tennessee to me. And I'm sure, like, I don't know about KJ, but for me, that's a part of me that I just don't even remember. I don't talk about it very much. I don't talk about my time there. I don't, you know, I just don't. You know, people ask me to come back and they're going to have reunions, and I don't have much to do with the university. I met my wife there. She's a diehard ball fan. So obviously there's friction there, but I, you know, it's, they should talk. When I think people, when they talk about Title IX and gender equity, they need to get athletes that have been, you know, affected by the programs being dropped, because it tears your heart out. For me, it just, I mean, that's a path that I don't go back to. And they used to have pictures in the hallway of All Americans. And I was reading an article that came out that they took those pictures and they just threw them in a dumpster, you know. So all the wrestling pictures and all Americans that were there, you know, it was, they didn't try to contact anybody. They just threw them in a dumpster. So that part of my wrestling history, I don't really bring up. I don't talk too much about.
Did you know that your wrestling career would lead down the path of coaching? That's where you're in right now. That's your profession. Did you think that it would lead to this point where you're a D1 college head coach?
You know, I when I was in ninth grade, I had a really great coach, and he just, you know, Coach Russo would just talk about, you know, mentoring and what it's just more than just wrestling and wins. It's developing a person as a character. And he did that for me. I mean, you know, from every time I went to nationals up to now, I see him at the tournament. We spend time together. So I just thought that was something that was really neat, like the influence he had in my life. I wanted to share that with other people. So from that point on, I always knew that I wanted to be involved. And I didn't know if it was D1. You know, I did a stand at Midwest City. I was there for 10 years, coaching as an assistant, in Oklahoma. You know, then I got a call to come to North Carolina. So it's funny how it worked out, but I always knew that that's something that I wanted to do, was to coach, because I felt like the influence you could have on young men, it's unbelievable.
There are 76 Division I college wrestling programs. Kerry McCoy just left Maryland, which leaves two African Americans now at head coaching positions. You see things about that. You see things where people question if we should have more. Is that a relevant talking point, Glenn?
I think it is. And I think it's sad, really. I think it definitely is. I think there's not. I look at the face of wrestling, and people talk about now the face of wrestling, you know, Jordan Burroughs, Snyder, but, you know, Jordan Burroughs is the face of wrestling. He might be the face of the wrestling part, but the corporate part, that face does not look like my face. And I, you know, I'm not a guy that goes around saying, oh, this is unfair, that's unfair. But I think there's a lot of, and I'll just speak, you know, because I'm a black male. I think the influence that you know, you look at Beat the Streak and all those things that, that the communities that they go into, and you look at the number of black head coaches, you know, I'm the last one. And, you look at that and it's a shame because I think that, you know, we have so much more to offer the sport than just out, than just wrestling, but the opportunity is just not there. I mean, anytime there's a job opening, I've never received a call about, hey, Glenn, would you be interested in this? Would you think about that? And then, you know, people are like, well, you got the Duke job and the Duke job, I was there for 2 years, but it was a perfect storm. My second year as an assistant, the Chronicle had an article that came out with us just said that, hey, look at, there's not a lot of minorities that are head coaches at Duke. There's not a lot of minorities that are in, you know, leadership roles at the university. Why is that? And about that time, Coach Anderson had retired. So it was kind of like, you know, Duke was looking at like, yeah, he might be qualified, but we really don't have, you know, we're kind of up against the wall here because we kind of have to look at him really. So I think it was like, yeah, it was like he's here, but two, it was like I said, it was the perfect storm. It came out that, you know, they kind of had to look at, you know, the opportunity more, and it was a great opportunity for me, obviously, because it got me into a position where you could be, you know, a D1 coach in an area where there's not a lot of D1 black coaches out there.
We talk about all the virtues of wrestling, whether it's anybody can wrestle and you can have a perceived handicap and overcome it. Is race an issue in wrestling?
You know, I always hear, and maybe I put this on myself, but I always, when you're going into the job, I talk to other people and they're like, hey, you make sure that, you know, you need to be doing good things at Duke because you have to open up the door for the next black coach that wants to come and coach. And, you know, yeah, you want to do that. And that's an added pressure, but you never hear about like, hey, John Smith, make sure that you're doing a great job because you're going to have to open up the door for the next guy that looks like John Smith to come in the door. So I feel like that's an added pressure. And I put that pressure on myself too, because I know that there's a lot of, you know, I know that there's a lot of minority coaches that want the opportunity to coach, but you know, that just, they don't have the chance. And I want to make sure that that's not an issue. So, you know, I try to do the best I can. Don't complain and just, you know, but like Coach Roderick said, don't make excuses, just win. And that's what I try to do.
How are you doing this at Duke? Andy broke this down for me about just some of the disadvantages you have at Duke with just no scholarships, athletic scholarships, and just the high cost to go to Duke. How are you getting this done?
We just recruit. I mean, we recruit super people. I've been blessed. I mean, obviously this program's been blessed. It's not all me. We, you know, the guys that we bring in here are guys that, first of all, that I like, and are guys that realize the importance of a great education that Duke is going to provide. And then they're just willing to work and they don't make excuses. You know, you talk about no scholarships. So, you know, you look at people like, well, the Ivy League, they don't have scholarships either, but the Ivy League, they all compete against each other. I'm in a conference that the five other schools are fully funded, probably three times our budget. But I just try to take all those excuses out. I tell our guys, look, I'm going to be here in the summer. The opportunity to train is going to be here. The opportunity to wrestle freestyle, to wrestle Greco, to be funded, to do that is going to be there. So you're going to have great coaches that are going to surround you and that are going to give you the opportunity to win. It's just like everything else. You have to step forward and decide you want to do that. So it started out with Connor Hartman and the guys that didn't get on the podium, like Emmanuel Kerr Brown and just guys like that that bought into that and just stayed during the summer and got internships and just trained during the summer. and became All-Americans, and Casper, and now Feinsilver. It's just guys like that that, you know, that you can look at and say, yeah, you can get it done at Duke. It's not easy, but there's nothing in life that's worth anything that's easy anyway. So, you know, just if you give them the opportunity, then we can win. And that's what I tell my guys when they go out on the mat.
I remember Conrad Dudziak saying when he was making his run to the finals, or he was having success, that people were surprised that Duke had a wrestling program. Do you still battle that people aren't even aware that you have a wrestling program at a basketball-rich school?
You run into that every now and then. Not as much as I used to. 4 or 5 years ago, going to the airport, you're going there and they're like, what sport are you? And you say wrestling, and they're like, Duke has wrestling? You know, so I think we're starting to get, you know, we had this about second top 25 finish, the sixth year in a row with an All-American, and, you know, multiple national qualifiers. We had five last year, we had five this year. So I think the name is starting to get out there, and people are starting to realize that Duke does have a wrestling program. But you still run into that every now and then.
Glenn, what are some of the things that you guys have to do differently there? I mean, we Kyle mentioned it, that you face some challenges that other people don't. I remember a conversation you and I had here a couple of years ago. You said your budget was like $150,000 or something along those lines. What are the obstacles you encounter that you have to overcome?
Well, you know, that for instance, if we want our budget limits us to travel. So if we want to go out to Vegas, which we've done for the past, you know, 3 years, that money has to be, we have to fundraise for that. So the our second assistant free, in order to keep him around in the program, that's fundraised for. So Southern Scuffle, you have to fundraise for all those things above and beyond uniforms. If you want more, you have to fundraise for that. So, and then summer training, you know, I look at some of the sports and I see the athletes, you know, they're taking summer school. Well, if our athletes take summer school, then that messes up their financial aid. So if they come back, then they have to end up paying for that out of their pocket. So if they stay during the summer, we have to give them a job, or they have to find an internship. So, you know, housing and all of those things that you're trying to do during the summer, and to get your guys better, you just have to constantly, you know, you have to rely on your alumni. And we're fortunate our alumni are starting to pick up and are starting to contribute more to the program. But but that's like I'm, you know, wearing a lot of hats, and that fundraising hat is definitely one that you have to constantly have on in order for your program. It's expensive being a top 25 team. I mean, when we were last in the country 5 years ago, that wasn't expensive at all. We stayed in North Carolina. We didn't go anywhere. But as soon as you start getting better, now you have to go out to Vegas, and you have to expose your guys to the Scuffle, and you have to go to the Keystone, and you have to go out to, you know, California, and you have to wrestle Stanford, and you have to wrestle in the Big Ten, and you have to, you know, you have to do more. And so it's very expensive. And we just, you know, our administration is at a point where they're not going to pay for any more. And I tell our alumni, if you want a better program, then you're going to have to dig into your pockets and help us out.
What kind of things do you guys do for fundraising?
Well, you know, a lot of it is just, you know, going out. I go out. If we have a match somewhere, like a UPenn match, we had a meet and greet with our alumni there, and we just try to get them involved in the program. We try to let them know what we're doing. We send out a newsletter constantly updating our alumni on our events. Also, we have a panel of alumni that are in different classes that reach out to inactive alumni and making sure that they get them inactive and get them involved in the program, get them more active in giving in the program. And then, too, at your year out, we tell our guys that are a year out that it doesn't matter if it's $20, $50, just get in a habit of writing a check to Duke Wrestling. And then when you can do more. But right now, make sure that that's a habit. It shouldn't be an excuse to say, well, coach, I'm not doing well right now. Hey, if you're not doing well, give us $10. Just do something. And so you gotta have the guys that graduate out of your program. And it's tough because some of our guys have to pay to go to school here. And then in addition, you're asking them for funds. But the Duke degree is a degree that continues to give, and it's a great opportunity and you're able to have a great experience at Duke. So at that time, it's always like you have to cultivate that atmosphere of giving, in order to keep things going. So we do that with our alum, with our young alumni, especially. So a year out, I'm in contact with those guys and we talk about, hey, you know, we have a giving campaign, just give something, be active. And that's what we try to do. But yeah, you just can't, there's either they're going to give or they're not. And, you know, my group, we're at 90 to 95% of active giving with the guys that have graduated from the program since I've been here. And we've got to continue to cultivate that if we want to have success. You have to be a fundraiser now. Administration, they're not going to do much for you anymore. They're going to keep the sport. But, you know, having a wrestling program and supporting a wrestling program is two different things. Sometimes administrators don't understand that. So you, like I said, you can't make excuses. You have to cultivate that. That has to be in your culture, giving back to your program.
Did you try to snag Zion Williamson for a couple dual meets, see if he could slide in there, cultivate him a little bit?
I would love that. I would love that. And I would promise him one thing. His Nike wrestling shoe would not blow out.
I mean, seriously, though, I would think he'd have a huge upside if he ever tried to wrestle.
You know, I was walking across the street during the summer before he came to Duke, and one of the assistants was walking across the street, and, you know, we waved, and we started talking, you know, just about basketball and a little bit about wrestling. And then he told me, he's like, hey, this freshman coming in, I know you heard about him, but I'm going to tell you, if you don't go to games, you need to go to games. He said he's a one in a million. You won't see a player like this come through Duke in a very, very long time. And he said he can do just about anything. So I saw Zion coming out of the athletic facility, super kid, nice kid, says hi to you every time he sees you. If I could have him as a heavyweight, I tell you what, it would be unbelievable because he's that physical a presence. If you see the kid, it's unbelievable. I would love to get him in a singlet.
So if you worked with him for a full year, could you get him to beat Jacob Casper?
I don't know about that. I don't know about that, but I think I could get him on the podium. I know that.
After how long? After a year, you could get Zion Williamson on the podium?
Hey, he is that athletic. I think after a year, you can get him on the podium.
All right.
And people might think you're crazy, but I mean, with that kid, with his athleticism, I think you could get him on the podium. A year of work and then him coming back and just wrestling that next season, you could get him on the podium.
Because how big is he?
I really believe that.
Yeah, he's huge. He's huge.
He's I would say 6'5", but I mean, he looks like he's a linebacker. I mean, he doesn't look like and you see some basketball players, they're put together, but this kid, it's unbelievable. I mean, he's a specimen. I like I said, I thought he played football at first. The only reason why, you know, I knew that because I saw him coming out of the basketball facility and cameras clicking and people hanging around and trying to get autographs and everything. And I, every time I see him, people ask for autographs, he never said no. And he sits there, he signs autographs, he talks to people, then he goes and works out. I don't know him, but what I see of him, he's a super kid.
So do you and Mike Krzyzewski ever kick back and have a cigar, talk shop? Do you guys do anything like that?
I tell you what, I had my first year as a head coach, I sat down with coach for 45 minutes, you know, and I was ready to, I mean, it was great, but I was ready to leave after, you know, 20 minutes. I was like, I don't want to take any more. But he, you know, he just talked about the Duke. He loves Duke. The guy loves Duke. And if you could get him to promote, you know, a program. And my first year, I had three recruits. He had them come up to his office and spoke with them. So his time is super valuable, but when he gives it to you, he gives it to you. Like I said, I've only sat down and talked to him once, but that was a long 45-minute conversation. So, he's a busy man.
When we talk about great coaches, of course, for us, Gable comes to mind. Cale's coming to mind now. What separates Coach K from the rest of the pack? He's in a unique lane as far as being one of the all-time greats. Did you glean anything out of that conversation that made you say, this guy, he has something special?
You know, it can cross over. You know, when you sit down and talk to John Smith, and when you sit down and talk to Coach K, when they talk about winning and preparation, and you can see this sparkle in their eye, and that this hunger that they have for success, you can see it in their eyes. And not too many people have that. That's why they're special. And when you sit down and when you talk to John, and John talks about the passion of winning and the sacrifice. And I've seen, you know, John sacrifice a lot of times just to get uncomfortable in situations. It's always the common theme that all of those guys have. When you sit down and talk to them, you can see it in their eyes, and you can hear it in their voice. That passion that they have for winning, it just drives them, and they're driven by that, where a lot of people they want to win, but that they're not. I think these guys are that consumes their lives. They think about it 24/7. And when I talked to Coach K for that time, and when I sat down and talked to John, I talked to John every now and then about jobs and about just situations. And John doesn't care if you don't have scholarships or whatever, or your budget's small. He just, John's like, well, how are you going to get him to win? How are you going to get him to believe in this? How are you going to get him to believe in that they can be special? How are you going to? And I remember talking to him the first time I picked this job, and that's what his thing was. It wasn't about, hey, Glenn, you have no scholarship. Hey, you have a small budget. Hey, you don't have a second to say. It's like, hey, how are you going to convince these guys to win? What are you going to do to get them over the top? And so that's the things I take out of talking to winners. Are not obsessed about obstacles. They're thinking about how to get over. They're not worried about what's in front of them. They're saying, hey, this is how I'm going to get over this. This is how I'm going to do this. Not like, oh, this is too big to climb, or this is my excuse to lose. I don't think any of those guys have that. It's not in their DNA. It's not in their DNA. That's just the way they're bred.
What quality do you have that makes you an effective coach?
You know, I've learned a little bit from every coach that I've been involved with, some good, some bad, and I just learn not to make those things. But I think it's just more, if I truly believe in you, and you put in the time, I think our guys know that, I'll go the distance, whatever it takes. And they've seen, I'll put my body on the line. I'll put anything on the line. If I truly believe, if you give me that time, and you truly believe in the process, I'll go the distance with you. And I think that our guys, like Jacob Casper and, Mitch and just anybody that has gone through that program, that's what they know. Hey, he might be tough, but he's fair and he's not going to sugarcoat it. But, like I said, a lot of it has just come from places I've been. And I think, when you look at building a program at Tennessee and then doing that and putting in the work and knowing what it takes, and then going into a program at Oklahoma State where everything is expected to you, you're expected to win. You're expected to have this persona that you carry around, that you're invincible and that nobody can beat you. And when you go into Iowa, you win, and that's what you do. And then you talk to your guys about that confidence. And that's the same thing. When I came to Duke, it's just changing that culture. People would look at Duke, oh, we're going to mop these guys up. I up until getting the job, or, you know, I didn't know Duke back in the day. Duke has had a program since 1927. I went all through my college career. I didn't know even Duke had risk. You know, I didn't even know. So just getting our guys to believe in what we're doing and to build that tradition. And, you know, you have to have that to lean on. And I think that that's what we're trying to do here. So I think that the thing that our guys can see in me is that, you know, that they know that I believe in what they're doing, and that, you know, that regardless of, we're going to find a way to win, and we're not going to make excuses, regardless of how tall the mountain is, we're going to get over it.
What quality?
That's what I try to relate to.
What quality do you wish you had? If there's maybe a blind spot that maybe an assistant coach has that you've been able to cover that gap, what quality do you wish you had that you could have as a head coach?
You know, sometimes, and I've learned to do this by watching my assistants, it always can't be my way or the highway. When I first got the job here, it was like one, that was it. That was the one, you know, this is the way to do it, that's the only way to do it. And as I looked in, you know, as I've gotten older, I've learned that there's more than one way to do it. And that's the way you have to coach it. So for me, I wish in my earlier years that I was more open to other ways of doing things, because I think I missed the boat on a lot of things that even as assistants had an ear for that I just didn't have an ear for. So I think that's one thing that I wish I would have been more open to, different ways of doing things. But, you know, that it's coaching is a learning process. And you know, you talk about being a wrestler, being a student athlete, you talk about learning. You're doing the same thing as a coach. I'm learning constantly. And when that time comes that I feel like I'm not learning, I'm going to get out, because to me, it's like, you know, you're not serving anybody if you're not constantly evolving as a coach. And I think that's a boat I missed early in my career.
Glenn, you have the Finesilver family, two sets of twins who can wrestle. What are you thinking when you've come across them in recruiting? I mean, that's got to be like finding a winning lottery ticket, I would think.
You know, I would love to have taken credit for catching Mitch and Zach, but obviously it was my assistant, Ben Whistle. He's gone on to, he's an AD at a high school in Indiana now. But I remember him telling me, he's like, hey, you got to see these twins. These kids are tough as nails. I've spoken with them on the phone. They're the type of guys that can change your program. I'm like, come on, really? And he's like, I promise you. So I got in contact with talked to Mitch. I just liked, they were very quiet, but they were confident in what they, and they wanted to be a part of a program that they wanted to change. They wanted to take it to the next level. And so I remember, you know, talking to the dad, and I was like, you know, hey, what are we doing with Mitch and Zach? You know, I think, you know, he's like, oh, coach, they're going to commit. They're going to commit. They're done. And I was like, oh, you know, that's great. I think they can really do some great things. And he's like, yeah. And if they like it, then Matt and Josh, the other two twins, will probably like it too. And I was like, what? you have other? Yeah. He's like, yeah, they're 3 years apart. They're in eighth grade. And I was like, oh my goodness, we got to get all of them. We got to get all of them. So it was a conscious effort to get every one of them. And it just worked out because, you know, they wanted to be the dad. If you Google the dad, I mean, he's a legend in Colorado when it comes to football. And I remember Mitch, his true freshman year, we had a guy in the lineup at 33 that, you know, just wasn't getting the job done. So, Mitch came in, and Mitch came back early to train. And I was like, hey, we're going to pull Mitch. And I said, I'm going to call his dad tonight. And I was like, all right, here we go. So I called the dad, and the dad's like, oh, I said, hey, we're going to pull Mitch. And the dad was like, all right, okay, coach, that sounds great. And I was waiting for like, are you kidding me? We're in the second half of the season. He's like, oh, coach, you're the coach. You pull him. So we pull Mitch, and Mitch Mitch goes out. We take him up to Pennsylvania. We wrestle in these duels at the University of Penn. And Mitch gets hammered. We wrestle four matches, and he gets just torched. And I was like thinking, oh, my goodness, what did I do? What did I do? And the dad calls. And I was like, I got the call. The dad's like, hey, he had a rough spot. But, Coach, I believe what you're doing. I believe you're going to get him going. I believe he's going to be a changed man. And so I go back there to Mitch, and I was like, Mitch, that cannot happen again. I do not need your dad on me. So Mitch was like, yes, sir, yes, sir. And sure enough, he ended up, you know, being a qualifier, being a ACC finalist his true freshman year and a four-time finalist and one-time champ. So, you know, like I said, the family's been great. They had a guy that have set the bar for staying, training, and all that kind of stuff.
Tell us about your depression glass collection. I think you have an emphasis on creamer and sugar sets. What got you interested in that?
But you know, it was funny. My mother-in-law got me a glass candy dish, and you know, she read up on it. She's like, "Hey, this is depression glass. You know, people collect it." And I was like, "Okay, so." I got hooked. I started, like, I went from salt and pepper shakers, and then I went to teacups, and I went to candy dishes. Yeah, I still collect. My wife is, we have four boxes of the fresh glass in the closet, and then she lets me display probably about 30 pieces, and then I try to sneak some out every now and then. And what she does is she'll take that piece that I have snuck out. She'll put it on the table and say, put this up. There'll be a note on it. Put this back up. So, but yeah, but it's, I think that my two passions, like I have outside of like wrestling is I like to collect glass and then I like to fish. I think that in this sport, I feel like you have to have a distraction, that can keep you sane. And so those are the things I do. I go to yard sales. I go to thrift shops. I go to flea markets, and I just like finding good bargains. I read up on like what's good glass, and I go out and collect. So yeah, that's my passion. I love doing it.
So would you say you're an expert in that field?
I think yes, I could definitely tell. I could tell patterns. I could tell phony glass, really, you know, depression glass from the 20s, 30s, 40s. I could tell different patterns. I think I'm almost, I went to a thrift shop. This is where I think I'm coming close to the expert, range. I went to a thrift shop and they had a piece on sale, for like $10. And I knew right away that it was like a $50 piece, you know, so I bought it for $10. I went home. I said, I need to make sure, opened up my book. And there it was. It was, you know, it was a $50 piece. So if it's fooling the people that are selling it, if they're getting, you know, if they're not experts on it, and I can go and pick it up, I feel like I'm approaching, you know, that peak where I'm an expert at it.
The depression glass is awesome. It's a great lane. But how cool would that have been if your collection happened to be fine silver?
Oh yeah. There you go. That is a great collection right there. That's a great pickup. You know, you talk about guys that change your program. You know, they make my job very easy because, you know, you're in the room and you have people that say, Coach, what can I do to get better? And I it's funny because I look at those, I can say, and you know, from Connor Hartman to Casper to the Fine Silvers, I just say, hey, just do, you see what those guys do? Whatever they do every day, you do what they do. And I guarantee you, you'll be better. Not just better wrestlers, but better people. Because that's what they are. They've been raised right. And they're just super people. They're respectful of time. You can work with them, do an individual, and there's not one time that they will leave without thanking you and shaking your hand. I mean, all 4 years of that, they'll come up and they'll shake your hand. And what was funny is, their first year, one of the coaches was like, hey, you don't do that. You don't need to do that. You don't need to thank, you don't need to thank us for everything. And so I gave each one of them, the outsiders, you know, because I wanted them to read that. And there's a part in there where one of the characters tells the other one, hey, stay golden, stay true to who you are. And that's what I told them. So I said, every time someone says, hey, you don't need to do that, I always say, hey, stay golden, stay true to who you are. If you're a yes sir, no sir, stick to those values. And that's what they've been raised right in. And I want them to always rely on those values. Don't ever change because someone's uncomfortable with you saying yes sir, no sir, and thanking them. Stay who you are. And that's what I tell them, stay true. So I don't always tell those guys, it's a little inside joke. When I talk to those guys, I always tell them, hey, stay golden, stay true. And that's they've been great for the program, and I can't say enough about them.
Our final question is a question from someone else. It comes from a Jacob Casper who wanted us to ask, of your three All-Americans, who did you enjoy coaching in the corner the most?
Wow. Man, that to me, that's Casper's competitive nature. I think there's little parts about each one of them, and this is probably my political answer, but there was little parts about each one of them that I enjoyed coaching. Like Casper's confidence, you know, his swagger. I love that about Casper. And then Hartman, his tenacity to overcome. Hartman wasn't the best athlete, but his ability to overcome that was unbelievable. And then Mitch's just evolution to a person who had the ability and finally believed in it, and seeing and being able to sit and watch that, so it's a combination of all three of those guys that I can collectively say that's what I enjoyed about watching him. Casper, when you watch his swag, I always loved, because he was the guy that, you know, Casper could sense like somebody just doing a little thing to him to try to get a one up on him, and he would give it right back. And that's one thing that we always had in common. So I would say that each one of them would bring something that I enjoyed being able to sit back and watch and coach.
Hey, man, this was awesome. When Andy said we got to get Glenn Lanham on, I understand why. This has been a fun time talking to you, and we really do wish you all the best. And thanks for sharing your story and taking us through Depression Glass and all of your battles with different opponents. We really appreciate this.
Hey, I want to thank you guys for just reaching out and letting us be able to get the Duke voice out, and we're going to keep doing that and keep having success. And thank you guys.
All right. We appreciate that. That was Glenn Lanham, head wrestling coach at Duke. It was our first time to talk with Coach Lanham on this program. And Andy, I'll just give you a hearty tip of the hat. I don't have a hat on, but you are absolutely right that we needed to get him on. I think you texted me right after Nationals and said, we got to get Glenn Lanham on. And he moved into an elite category of just absolutely outstanding interviews we've had.
For sure. Yeah. I think there are more that are in that category than not. That's what's been fun about this show.
You're right.
Is that week after week, we've found a way to get some really intriguing guests on here and hear some great stories. And man, that was a lot of fun. There's a lot that I learned about Glenn during that time, and a lot that I learned about Duke wrestling and what those guys are up against there, and yet you're not going to hear him complain a whole lot about it.
I think Glenn just was like, I'm throwing down here. I'm gonna give you one of the big boy interviews. I'm going to show you I'm as good as everyone else, and he absolutely came through with that. I think he showed that he's as good as anyone out there. He can articulate himself as well as anyone we've had on the show. And you listen to that, and my first thought is, I would love to wrestle for this guy or compete for this guy or be involved with the program. All of those things came into my head as I was listening to him. And if I lived in North Carolina, I would find every reason to get involved with that program, because he's doing the right things, and a lot of people believe in his product, and this is why. So really, really glad we got to hear that and have him share that with us.
Yeah, and look at what they did this year. I mean, for a program like that to finish in the top 25, and look at some of the programs that weren't in the top 25 or programs that finished behind Duke. And you're talking about some programs in there that have longer, richer traditions, programs that are in fertile recruiting bases, programs with 9.9 scholarships, and yet you're seeing Duke ahead of them. It's a tremendous testament to what Glenn and his staff have done down there, and really cool. Hopefully, they continue to have success and they continue to get backers behind them that move the needle a little bit, and hopefully one day, their administration jumps on board too and starts offering some assistance in terms of scholarship dollars and more funding for the program. I think that'd be awesome because what they're doing with what they have is pretty incredible.
I want to hang out with him and I want to have a full meal on his depression glass. It doesn't sound like that's going to happen. I think he'll use his traditional if we ever get down there, but I'd love to see his collection and just another unique facet of Glenn Lanham that we got to learn about. This has been fun. We had Glenn Lanham on the show. We had one of his pupils. I'm sure Jacob Casper will say it was his favorite pupil, but we had a Casper's Corner. For Andy Hamilton, Jacob Casper, and Glenn Lanham, I'm Kyle Klingman. You have been listening to On the Mat.
This show is part of the Matt Talk Podcast Network. For more wrestling podcasts, head over to MattTalkOnline.com.